It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday News. Thank you for listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It's your public radio station, broadcasting from Signal Hill here in Kodiak, where it's 41 degrees. I'm looking for cloudy skies, high near 43 today, west wind to 15, gusting as high as 25. Mostly cloudy skies tonight with a low around 34 and southwest winds to 10. Mostly cloudy skies, high near 42 tomorrow, and cloudy skies tomorrow night, but mostly sunny skies on Friday. Friday looks like our sunny day. Coming up on the midday report, the Kodiak Island Ambulatory Care Clinic is holding a COVID vaccination clinic on Saturday. Anchorage officials are looking to launch a smartphone app to help people track exposure to COVID, but they're waiting for the governor's okay. And a House bill would seek to give federally recognized tribes in Alaska the same recognition by the state. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Biden administration's warned that migrant crossings at the southwest border are on track to reaching their highest level in 20 years. President Biden says the new surge started with the last administration, but it's now his administration's responsibility to put a stop to it. To that end, he's launched a new diplomatic push to coordinate with Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras to address the root causes of the surge in migration. Vice President Kamala Harris is taking the lead.
While we are clear that people should not come to the border now, we also understand that we will enforce the law and that we also, because we can chew gum and walk at the same time, must address the root causes that that cause people to make the trek, as the president has described, to come here.
The most urgent part of the crisis involves thousands more unaccompanied minors making the crossing. The administration is scrambling to find more temporary housing for them. In Colorado, loved ones are remembering the 10 individuals killed in this week's mass shooting at a King Soopers grocery store in Boulder. One of the victims, Ricky Olds, was on track to becoming store manager. But as NPR's Kirk Sigler reports, because of the actions of a gunman, Ricky's family is now left grieving over what could have been.
25-year-old Ricky Olds was shot and killed in the massacre while working her shift. Her uncle, Robert Olds, says the family is devastated. His niece will never be able to experience motherhood or fulfill her life goal of helping others.
There's a hole. There's a hole in our family that won't be filled. I mean, we try to fill it with memories. You know, but it's tough.
Old says his family has been overwhelmed by what he calls an outpouring of support, including a candlelight vigil that was held here outside the family's home Tuesday night. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Boulder.
The administration is trying to reassure U.S. allies in Europe that they won't have to choose between the U.S. and China. But Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Western democracies should rally to uphold the international order. Here's NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Secretary Blinken is vowing to consult early and often with European partners as he tries to, in his words, modernize America's alliances. He says countries should work with China where possible, including on climate change. But he also says the U.S. and Europe need to compete with China in other areas and uphold the international system.
Because if we work together to make real our positive vision for the international order, we're confident we can outcompete China or anyone else on any playing field.
His speech in Brussels comes just a week after Blinken's testy first meeting with top Chinese diplomats. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The Nasdaq has closed down 2% since the open. This is NPR News.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
The Kodiak Island Ambulatory Care Clinic will be holding another drive-through COVID vaccination clinic this upcoming Saturday with expanded availability. 300 doses will be distributed. The clinic will be from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. for second-time doses and from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. for first-time doses on March 27th. That's happening at AAA Storage and Warehouse. Registration is available at kiacc.com. That's kiacc.com. Currently, the state of Alaska does not recognize tribes the same way the federal government or states in the lower 48 do. A measure in the state house would amend state law to officially recognize most tribes of Alaska. Advocates say that pushing for that formal recognition is about changing the relationship between the state and tribes. KNBA's Trip Krause dives into why that recognition matters for the whole state.
House Bill 123 would change state law so that Alaska officially recognized tribes in the state in the same way that the federal government does. The federal government recognizes 229 tribes in Alaska. One of them is the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. Chakya Ish Peterson is president.
It's somewhat ironic to be asking for recognition, but we know that it's so important in our day-to-day business as tribes.
Peterson spoke to a House Special Committee meeting on tribal affairs. There are 574 federally recognized tribes in the U.S.
I think that it's not lost on many of us that those tribes here in Alaska, making up half of the tribes in the United States, are still struggling to be recognized here.
Recognition is a complicated concept that could be a whole story in itself, but it's easiest to understand as something that would give the state more flexibility and opportunities to partner with tribes. If passed, the bill would provide jurisdiction to the tribes over its citizenship, residence, and over water and land ownership. It's helpful to think of this jurisdiction not as a physical boundary that tribes would have control of, but as an added layer of local governmental control. Walthall Gedock Barbara Blake is director of the Alaska Native Policy Center at the First Alaskans Institute. Blake also spoke before the Tribal Affairs Committee. She says that three sovereigns are at work in the United States: federal, the states, and the tribes. This issue of sovereignty is thorny. A lot of people tend to think that expanding tribal sovereignty will diminish the power of the state and federal governments. Blake says it's actually an opportunity to strengthen the relationships between tribes, the state, and federal government, and for tribes to provide more services and bring more funding into the state for things that both want to accomplish.
These institutions are all providing services to citizens of the United States and citizens of the state and citizens of our tribal nations. Services that are complementary to each other, services that we know can go that much further by working together and finding opportunities to streamline how we all operate in this state.
Another barrier to the state's recognition of tribal sovereignty is that a lot of people tend to think that there's a hierarchy, that one government has more control or authority than another. Laganai Liz Medicine Crow is president and chief executive officer of the First Alaskans Institute, and she says that's not true.
But when it comes to being able to come together nation to nation and make agreements, that is the place not only of coming to really critical decisions that need to be made, but it is a place of nation building. And for Alaska, that's something that we could have here as well, a place of building a better state.
So what is the state doing right now? Well, instead of recognizing tribes and tribal organizations and sovereigns and letting them have local control over certain services, the state signs contracts or compacts with them. It's best to think of contracts as agreements between two or a small group of parties with the expectations to deliver goods or services by accomplishing X, Y, and Z, and it usually comes with a deadline. But while contracts are legally binding agreements, tribal organization leaders like Liz Medicine Crow say contracting limits and constrains tribal service providers too much.
You're getting the result that you pay for when it comes to contracting, because the bar for success is being held onto so tightly that they cannot do what they really need to be able to do. And there's so much tight control and wanting to have power and control over it that in fact it's suffocating the system from being able to really achieve what's possible in provision of public service to our communities and public safety to our communities.
The other avenue of government-to-government relations between tribes and the states are compacts. Through compacts with the state, tribes help fund services by leveraging federal money, money that the state may not have access or capacity to deliver. Areas of opportunities for compacting include in child welfare, education, public safety, as well as transportation. Tribes, the state, and the federal government often legally spar over jurisdictions. Most recently, the Metlakatla Indian Reserve sued the state and federal court in regards to fishing rights. And the state sued the federal government for giving tribes optional out-of-season hunting rights out of concerns for food scarcity and security during the early months of the pandemic. Alaska Native Policy Center Director Blake says that a closer relationship, one based on mutual respect as equals, would limit the amount of times that legal action is necessary. In Anchorage, I'm Tripp Krause.
Anchorage officials say they're pushing closer to the launch of a smartphone app that could alert people they've been exposed to COVID-19. City leaders say the tool could help stop the spread of the virus more quickly than contact tracers. But as Nat Herz with Alaska Public Media reports, the initiative is hung up waiting for approval from Governor Mike Dunleavy's administration.
Some 24 states from Washington to Wyoming to North Carolina have already launched what are known as exposure notification apps. Want to visit Maui? Well, you can't unless you put a COVID-19 tracking app on your smartphone.
Download the Aloha Safe Alert app and help protect your ohana and our community and accelerate Hawaii's recovery.
Authorities have been using phones since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic to help break chains of transmission, including in some countries like China and Israel, where governments used data without people's permission. Anchorage's idea is very different from that.
For those who are deeply concerned about their personal freedoms and their personal privacy, congratulations. You don't have to use this app. It is purely voluntary.
Bill Popp is president of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, which has endorsed the plan from the city government. The apps that Anchorage wants to use will only work if and when people choose to turn them on. The technology uses random numbers automatically exchanged over Bluetooth when two people's phones are close enough together for COVID exposure. Those numbers stay on users' phones and only are uploaded to a server without identifying information if a person later tests positive and chooses to use the app to alert others. Here's Pop again.
I honestly do not understand, with the idea that this tool is purely voluntary, how it could ever be interpreted as big government or big brother trying to get another foothold into your personal life.
The apps are designed to complement public health agencies' contact tracing efforts. That's a separate virus containment measure in which employees interview people who have tested positive in an effort to identify others who may have been exposed. Contact tracers in Anchorage and other states have periodically faced backlogs when cases have surged. And Brendan Babb, Anchorage's chief innovation officer, says the exposure notification apps can help alert close contacts more quickly.
Shaving off those days really lets you break the chain of transmission for COVID.
Even if people don't decide to use the apps in large numbers, they can still be effective. Babb points to estimates from British researchers showing that for every 1% increase in users, COVID-19 infections can be reduced by as much as 2.3%. But not everyone is on board with the new technology quite yet.
We don't see the exposure notification app as being the single most highly effective tool compared to other strategies.
That's Alaska's chief medical officer, Dr. Ann Zink. The Dunleavy administration, to which Zink belongs, would have to sign off on the apps for them to launch in Alaska. But she says it's not ready to do that quite yet. The state health department is focused right now on distributing COVID-19 vaccines.
We're not a hard no. We got a lot going on, and we're having to prioritize what is going to have the biggest impact.
Babb, the Anchorage city official, says he thinks it's a matter of if, not when, the state will sign off. The city has hired a marketing firm to plan for the launch, and two allied business groups, the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation and Visit Anchorage, have both written to Alaska's health commissioner in recent days to ask him to sign off on the apps. Babb says the system could launch within a few weeks of the Dunleavy administration giving its permission. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
More than 5 weeks after Governor Mike Dunleavy's disaster declaration was allowed to expire, Dunleavy and some legislators disagree with other lawmakers over whether to bring it back. Those affected by the expiration say it's time to resolve the deadlock. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman has this report.
After Juneau resident Ted Merrill had lung cancer surgery in early February in Seattle, his wife Lucy Merrill hoped he'd be able to have his follow-up scans done in Juneau. Ted's surgeon said that wasn't possible.
He said, unfortunately, because Alaska doesn't have the COVID emergency thing in place any longer, he cannot do telemedicine with Alaska residents.
That's because Governor Dunleavy's disaster declaration expired on February 14th. The House hadn't organized in time to pass an extension Dunleavy proposed. Lucy Merrill says that means Ted has to fly down to Seattle for the scans. Dunleavy and the legislature have different ideas about what to do next. The governor says the COVID-19 situation in Alaska has improved enough that a full disaster declaration is no longer necessary. He described what he wants instead earlier this month.
I don't think we need to be looking at a full-blown health declaration.
He credits Alaskans with making that possible.
We're working with the legislature to get a bill passed that would be very limited, very focused.
Republican legislators have worked with Dunleavy's administration on legislation that would be more limited. It would support the telemedicine that patients like Ted Merrill benefit from. It gives the administration the authority to allocate and distribute vaccines, and it allows the state to accept federal relief, like $8 million a month in food assistance to families. But the delays have been more than frustrating for groups that never wanted to see the disaster declaration end, like Alaska's hospitals and most municipalities. Jared Kosin has been hearing that from hospital leaders. He's president of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. And these leaders are telling Kosin it makes no sense to give up some of the governor's disaster declaration powers during the pandemic, especially the mandate that all arriving air passengers be tested for the coronavirus.
I understand that Alaskans are fatigued, and I completely respect that, and we're fatigued. But if you just take a step back and look at what's the most logical, efficient way to deal with this, we are not taking that path right now.
Kosin says it's inevitable that fewer passengers are being tested without the mandate. And hospitals are concerned that's contributed to COVID spread in communities like Petersburg, which experienced an outbreak after the declaration expired.
And then ask yourself, is that productive for getting us through the pandemic and back to a fully functional open economy? And I think the answer is no, it is not productive. It only has the potential to set us back.
On Monday, the House Finance Committee passed a bill that's similar to what Dunleavy wanted before the declaration expired. At least some Republican legislators say they're hearing from constituents that they don't want the state to be under a disaster declaration. Nikiski Republican Representative Ben Carpenter says the bill advancing in the House attempts to force Dunleavy into a disaster declaration he doesn't want.
And I think that is a mistake. It is a bad precedent to set. It is not necessary, as we've heard laid out by members of his administration, to address the COVID crisis.
As the two chambers consider different bills, some Alaskans just want the issue resolved. Lucy Merrill in Juneau says doing that sooner would have saved her and her husband Ted a lot of aggravation and money on airfare to Seattle and a hotel.
I don't care who does it. I just wanted to get it done and fixed.
The House could pass the bill that would extend the disaster declaration in the coming days. The Senate Finance Committee is scheduled to hear the Senate version of the legislation on Wednesday. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Today's KMXT Local News is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Alaska hatcheries again make a huge contribution to salmon catches. More after this.
Halibut and black cod buyers and sellers, simplify your sales online from one location at the Seafood Auction. Visit seafoodauction.net.
Last year, nearly 31 million salmon that got their start in Alaska hatcheries were caught in commercial fisheries, or 27% of the statewide harvest, mostly pinks and chums. The dockside value of $69 million made up 23% of the total salmon value. That's according to the annual Salmon Enhancement Report by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. There are 30 hatcheries producing salmon in Alaska, of which 26 are operated by private nonprofits funded primarily from sales of a portion of the returns called cost recovery. 11 are state-owned and operated at no cost to the state. At Prince William Sound, where 6 hatcheries operate, about 15 million hatchery salmon were harvested in 2020, worth about $27 million at the docks, or 67% of the total value for the region. At Southeast Alaska, 14 hatcheries operate. Last year, under 4 million hatchery salmon were caught, accounting for 45% of the total harvest and 52% of the value to fishermen of $18 million. 2 hatcheries operate at Kodiak, where last year nearly 5 million hatchery salmon were harvested, worth roughly $5 million, or 11% of the total dockside value. The 3 hatcheries at Cook Inlet produced just under 200,000 salmon, valued at $585,000, or 6.9% of the region's total to fishermen. Alaska's hatcheries released 1.7 billion juvenile salmon in 2020 and are projecting a return this year of nearly 66 million fish. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods, who salutes and says thanks to the men and women fishing across Alaska for their hard work and dedication. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
Domestic and sexual violence harms our collective humanity. These assaults devastate victims, hurt family and friends, and diminish the lives of perpetrators. Respect is a choice we make to respect ourselves and respect others. Join Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center in a social media challenge to promote community wellness and raise awareness of the impact of domestic and sexual violence. To find out how to participate, find KWRCC on Facebook and help us show that Kodiak chooses respect.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger. For Wednesday, it is the 24th day of March, the year 2021. It is currently 41 degrees here in beautiful downtown Kodiak. Nope, it's up to 42 degrees. Under cloudy skies, pretty pleasant day though. We're looking to get to 43 today. West wind to 15 miles per hour, could gust as high as 25 this afternoon. Our record high is 54 for this day. That was set in 2020 last year. And our record low was 5, set in 2003. The sun rose today at 7:58 this morning. It won't set again until 8:33 p.m., giving us 12 hours and 35 minutes of glorious daylight. That is a gain of 5 minutes compared to yesterday. We have a low tide coming up here on the east side at 6:19 p.m. That will be a 0.5-foot tide, followed by a high tide at 1 a.m. of 6.4 feet. And our low tide for tomorrow morning on the east side will be at 6:09 a.m. and be 3 feet. Over on the west side, you have a low tide coming up at 6:50 p.m. That will be a 1.8-foot tide, followed by a high tide at 1:25 a.m. of 15 feet, and your low tide for tomorrow morning on the west side will be at 7:04 a.m. and 5.1 feet. We're looking for cloudy skies tonight, low around 34, southwest wind to 10 miles per hour, mostly cloudy tomorrow too, with a high near 42, south wind to 5. Mostly cloudy skies on Thursday night, but gradually becoming mostly clear overnight on Thursday, with a low around 31 and west winds to 10. And for Friday, mostly sunny skies, high near 40, west wind to 15, gusting as high as 20 on Friday. Friday is looking like our sunny day, although maybe sunny, maybe Sunday. Mariners, here's your synopsis for the North Gulf Coast, including Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet. An area of weak low pressure will linger in the northern Gulf through Friday morning. As a result of that, Marmot Island Sitkanak is going to have a small craft advisory through Thursday. West wind 30 knots right now and seas to 10 feet. For tomorrow, southwest wind to 25 knots and seas to 10 feet. And for Thursday night, west wind to 20 knots and seas to 7 feet. In the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory through Thursday. Southwest wind to 30 knots and seas to 11 feet. Freezing spray in the morning. For tonight, southwest 30, seas to 11 feet. And for Thursday, southwest 30, seas to 8 feet, subsiding to 5 feet Thursday afternoon in the Shelikof. Attention all mariners, bring your sea stories to Comfish Alaska. Our stories pull our community together, and while we can't wait to get you back on that Comfish stage, this year we hope to see you from the other side of the video screen. In the spirit of the Alaska fishing community's resiliency, the virtual trade show and forum are fully interactive and immersive. I actually signed up today. The Kodiak Chamber of Commerce will feature the pre-recorded stories during virtual receptions at 5 p.m. on the 30th and the 31st. Please help them capture and share a few of the many stories that make up the fabric of our rich maritime history by recording a 3 to 5 minute fish tale either into your smartphone or your computer. If you are recording on your phone, please hold the camera horizontally. Email your stories to Teresa Peterson at Teresa, T-H-E-R-E-S-A, at akmarine.org, or Phil Lampron. That's phil.lampron, L-A-M-P-R-O-N, at kodiakhealthcare.org. And that needs to happen by March 26th, so you have 2 more days. Better get on that. And as we just heard, Comfish Alaska 2020 is happening the 30th and the 31st. This year's trade show and fisheries forums will be virtual, yet very social and engaging. Registration and how-to information can be found at comfishak.com. The Senior Citizens of Kodiak Board of Directors will be holding a regular monthly meeting today at 1 p.m. in the center's multipurpose room. Masks and social distancing will be required, and the meeting's open to the public. For more information, call 486-6181. Also meeting today at 1 p.m., the Mission Lake Tide Gate Service Area Board. They're having their public budget hearing, and that's happening in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 1 p.m. today. Tonight at 6:30 p.m. in the Bayside Fire Hall, Service Area Number 1 is having their board meeting and their public budget hearing and regular meeting. Again, that's 6:30 p.m. at the Bayside Fire Hall. And Thursday at 6:30 p.m. in the Bayside Fire Hall, the Borough Assembly will be having their work session. So the Borough Assembly work session, 6:30, Thursday, Bayside Fire Hall. Also on Thursday, the Kodiak City Council will hold a regular meeting. That's happening at the Kodiak Public Library's multipurpose room. The meeting is open to the public and will be broadcast on KMXT right here on 100.1 FM. Agendas and meeting packets are available online at the City of Kodiak's website. To request paper copies or additional information, call the city clerk at 486-8636. Kodiak College's Technology Center is having one of those great outboard repair and maintenance workshops. This next one is happening on April 9th. It goes from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's a 2-day workshop covering theory and hands-on maintenance of 2-stroke and 4-stroke outboard engines, 25 horses and larger. Classroom instruction is organized by 3 major components of the outboard: power head, midsection, and lower unit. Hands-on practice in the lab follows each section that is covered in the classroom. Topics include machinery, compression tests, changing spark plugs, oil changing, troubleshooting, etc. This class is for set netters, sport fishing enthusiasts, owners of commercial fishing vessels, anyone. The class fee is $225, but they are fantastic classes, and it's appropriate for ages 14 and up. For more information, contact Lorraine Stewart at 486-1209. That's 486-1209.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.